Imagine writing a check for like $5 million today, locking it in a vault, and just knowing that even if you somehow manage to pick the next massive tech unicorn, that money is gonna actively drain your bank account every single day for the next decade.
Yeah, it's a terrifying prospect.
It really is. So, welcome to the deep dive. We usually hear about the overnight unicorn successes, right? The glamorous launch parties, the headlines about these massive valuations.
Absolutely, the highlight reel.
Exactly. But today we are looking at the really gritty, often super painful reality of what happens long after that initial investment check is cashed. We're unpacking a brutally honest insider's perspective on the realities of angel investing and startup survival.
Right, and we're basing this on notes from over a decade in the trenches, literally titled The Bumpy Road to Exit by Fred Cohen.
And the overarching theme here, it goes far beyond just simple financial modeling. It's a profound look at human resilience, the psychology of failure and the hidden mechanics of time.
I mean, the core thesis established in these notes is just that the road to an exit, or even just seeing preliminary dividends, is staggeringly long. And the eventual value of these companies, it has to be astronomically high just to justify a wait that routinely stretches well over a decade.
Which is wild to think about. But before we can even look at the complex math of that 10-year wait, I feel like we need to understand how these companies actually die on the vine.
Right, we need an autopsy of a startup.
Exactly. Because the causes of death in the trenches are very, very different from what makes the headlines. Like reading the news, you might assume the startup ecosystem is just crawling with malicious con artists, but the data here shows something totally different.
It really does. I mean, out of all the equity positions analyzed over a 10-year span in this text, there were only three actual frauds.
Which is a remarkably low incident rate for a whole decade.
Right. But examining the mechanics of those frauds reveals a lot about the startup environment. So one was a case of outright malicious lying.
Okay, pretty straightforward.
Yeah. But the second is much more common. It's a founder who got in entirely over their head trying to, quote unquote, hack growth.
Wait, how does that actually cross the line into fraud, though? Because, I mean, growth hacking is practically a religion in Silicon Valley.
Oh, for sure. But it becomes fraudulent when the narrative completely detaches from the underlying reality and the founder starts, believing their own manufactured metrics. Imagine a founder who buys fake users or manipulates engagement data just to hit a specific metric for their next funding round.
Right, just trying to survive the next quarter.
Exactly. They convince themselves they will figure out the real revenue model later. But eventually, that manufactured data becomes literally the only thing keeping the lights on. Yeah, they cross the line from being overly optimistic to actively deceiving their investors just to survive.
That's a slippery slope.
It is. And the third fraud case followed a really similar pattern, just a team simply hiding how precarious their financial situation was to keep the checks coming.
So, malice is actually rare, but desperation breeds deception.
Precisely.
Then the notes move from the malicious to the purely tragic. There is a really sobering reality check here regarding the physical toll of this environment.
Yeah.
The author notes that he had two friends die in office while serving as CXOs, meaning like chief executive technology or operations
Yeah,
officers.
in startups they had actually invested in.
Right. And this exposes a massive structural vulnerability in early stage companies, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. I
Right.
mean, a mature corporation has succession plans, right? They have structural redundancy. If an executive falls ill, the machine just keeps running.
They have a deep bench.
Exactly. But in a fledgling startup, the company essentially is the founder. These companies lacked the structural redundancy to operate without the extraordinary singular effort of those specific individuals.
Right.
So when those executives tragically passed away, the companies literally died with them. There was no safety net to catch the operations.
That is just heartbreaking. So we have the rare frauds and the tragic sudden losses. But the vast majority of these companies fail through what the notes simply call crashes.
Which basically just boiled down to running out of cash.
Right. And the text divides these into slow crashes and fast crashes. Fast crashes usually happen when inexperienced leaders blatantly ignore advice and just drive the company straight into a brick wall.
Yeah, 0 to 60 right off a cliff.
But logically, I mean, wouldn't a fast crash be infinitely worse for the investor? Because you instantly lose your entire investment in a matter of months rather than years.
That is the assumption most people make. But the reality on the ground flips that logic completely.
Really?
Yeah, from a purely financial standpoint, a fast crash and a slow crash drain the exact same amount of money. The initial investment goes to zero either way.
Okay, that makes sense.
The critical difference is the human toll. A slow crash involves little to no money coming in, no viable path to revenue that exceeds costs, yet the leadership just keeps pushing the boulder up the hill.
Oh man, so they stretch it out over years of just slowly bleeding capital.
And that drawn-out bleed consumes immense emotional energy. The notes detail how these slow crashes take such a heavy toll on the CEOs that some have actually lost their spouses in the process.
This is awful.
Others have become completely estranged from their families. A fast crash is financially painful, sure, but it is a clean break.
Right. You rip the Band-Aid off.
Exactly. It spares the founder's soul, allowing them to mourn the failure and just move on.
Wow. Okay, so if slow crashes are so devastating, the obvious question is why any rational person would endure one. I mean, think about the sunk cost fallacy in your own life, right?
Oh, we all do it.
Yeah, maybe staying in a bad job or a failing relationship just because you've already put so much time into it. Why don't these founders just course correct or shut down before hitting the wall?
Well, the answer lies in a really specific type of psychological blindness, which is inflexibility. CEOs frequently fail because they just completely ignore facts.
They just put their blinders on.
Pretty much. They operate on the assumption that their initial vision is inherently correct, even when faced with glaring, contradictory market evidence.
Right.
And the source material is remarkably candid about this. The author actually admits that his own inflexibility running startups since the 1970s led to both successes and failures.
I mean, betting on yourself is kind of a prerequisite for starting a company in the first place, so it makes sense that stubbornness is a universal trait among founders.
It is, yeah.
But the text emphasizes a really crucial distinction for survival. The ideal CEO isn't the one who never makes a mistake. It's the one who is smart enough to know that they're not smart enough to do it on their own.
That self-awareness is the dividing line. It literally determines whether a mistake is fatal or recoverable.
Right.
The notes break down the anatomy of these failures into two distinct categories. One big mistake versus many small mistakes.
Okay, let's unpack that.
So big mistakes almost always stem from a total lack of risk management. It's a catastrophic decision based on terrible information. And it's usually pushed through because there is absolutely no group decision-making process to challenge the CEO's assumptions.
But wait, I mean, the whole mythology of business is built on the one big mistake paying off, right?
Mm.
You hear these stories about founders betting the entire company payroll on a wild guess or like a single pivot, and it turns them into a $1 billion empire.
Sure. The text acknowledges that this does happen. Quite a few highly successful people bet it all on a guess and win big.
Right.
But we suffer from massive selective data in business media.
It's the ultimate survivorship bias. I mean, praising a CEO who bet the entire company on a wild guess and won is literally like interviewing a lottery winner for financial planning advice.
That is a perfect way to put it.
You're looking at the one person holding the giant novelty check on the magazine cover, but you never see the 10,000 other people who made the exact same bet, bought the exact same ticket, and lost absolutely everything.
Exactly. That analogy captures the danger perfectly. We only write case studies about the gambles that paid off, which, you know, encourages new founders to take existential risks without a safety net.
Right. It's dangerous.
But the other side of the coin is many small mistakes. Everyone makes small mistakes. They are a daily inevitability in business.
Right. You can't avoid them.
But the notes argue that small mistakes only become fatal if the company lacks maturity.
Okay. So if small mistakes only kill immature companies, the ultimate safety net isn't having some genius founder who never misses a shot. It's having boring, repeatable corporate processes that catch those daily errors early.
Precisely. The test explicitly defines the maturity stages a company actually must progress through to survive these inevitable small mistakes.
And what are those stages?
There are none. Initial, repeatable, defined, managed, and optimized.
Okay, let's actually walk through what that progression looks like on a mechanical level. So if a company is at none or initial, it's just pure chaos, right? Like every problem is a brand new emergency.
Right, everyone's just running around putting out fires. But moving to repeatable means you start documenting the basic things. So you aren't reinventing the wheel every single time a customer has an issue.
Makes sense.
Then defined means standardizing those processes across the entire company. So the sales team and the engineering team are actually operating from the same playbook.
Got it. And then managed and optimized is where the real safety net forms, right?
Exactly. Managed means you are actively tracking the success rate of your processes. And optimized means the system is continuously improving itself based on that data.
So it's basically a self-healing system.
Yeah. When a company builds that structured framework, the effects of a small mistake are detected and corrected almost immediately, often before the customer even notices.
That's the dream.
The organization learns. You stop making the same type of error over and over. And this leads to one of the most crucial insights in the material. Mistakes are inevitable, but failure by mistakes is not.
I love that. So a founder survives the early chaos. They avoid the catastrophic one big mistake by listening to their team. They build through the maturity stages to insulate the company from the daily small mistakes.
Right. They do everything right.
And they avoid the agonizing slow crash. Now they are stable and they enter the waiting game for an exit. But this waiting game introduces a completely different silent killer for the investor. And that killer is time.
Oh, time. Time is the great eroding force in investing.
It really is.
The notes actually introduce this phase with a really poignant nod to Frank Sinatra. The author reflects on his successes by quoting the song My Way, stating, "I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention."
Yeah, which is a reflection on a very long road. He notes that while some small exits occur, the larger ones, the exits that actually make the underlying math of angel investing work, are taking anywhere from 5 to 12 years.
And during that 5 to 12 year gap, time actively destroys capital through the mechanics of inflation.
This part is brutal.
The numbers provided are stark. Over a 10-year waiting period, assuming just a 6% inflation rate, you lose about 44% of the buying power of your savings.
That is insane. Nearly half of your money's actual value just evaporates. Let's break down how that actively harms an investor, though, because if you have $1 million in a normal liquid account, you can move it into high-yield bonds or other vehicles to combat that inflation.
Right.
But you can't do that here.
No, you can't, because startup equity is entirely non-public and non-liquid. This is what the text describes as the cash flow trap.
Right.
When you invest in an early-stage startup, your capital is locked in a vault, and you do not hold the key.
Wow.
You cannot pull out a little bit of interest to pay your grocery bills. You cannot sell 5% of your shares to cover a medical emergency. You are just waiting for a liquidity event, meaning the company either goes public through an IPO or is acquired by a larger corporation.
Right.
Until that liquidity event happens, your equity yields zero usable cash.
Zero. And while that money is locked up yielding nothing, your daily life continues to cost money. The notes lay out this brutal hypothetical. If you have yearly living expenses of $100,000 over the 10 years you are waiting for the startup exit, you will spend $1 million just to survive.
Just on basics.
Yeah. Mortgages, groceries, keeping the lights on.
And this culminates in a mathematical reality that fundamentally redefines who can actually afford to be an angel investor in the first place.
Definitely.
Let's walk through the final calculation presented in the material. Say you want to invest $5 million across a portfolio of startups. Historically, the average return for a successful angel portfolio might be around 9 times the initial investment.
Okay, so on paper, that $5 million should eventually turn into $45 million over a decade. That sounds like an incredible financial strategy.
On paper, yes. But the cash flow trap destroys that strategy if you aren't already massively wealthy. Because of the illiquidity, having $5 million to invest is nowhere near enough. If your living expenses dictate that you need a substantial cash cushion to survive for a decade, you actually need a total net worth closer to $10 million just to make that initial $5 million investment.
That is wild. You need the first $5 million to put into the startups, and you need another $5 million kept in completely separate, highly liquid assets just to generate enough accessible interest to pay your daily bills for those 10 years without going broke.
Exactly. The realization here for you, the listener, is that angel investing isn't just a game of picking the smartest founder or the most disruptive technology.
Right.
It requires a massive separate engine of liquid wealth just to survive the decade-long wait for the payoff. Because the delay fights against inflation and time eats away at your available funds.
Yeah.
If your investments aren't keeping up with inflation and you don't have separate cash to maintain your reserves, you are quite literally losing money every single day. You wait for that shiny launch party to turn into an actual exit.
Which is such a paradigm shift. But I think whether you are managing a venture capital fund, grinding it out as an entrepreneur, or just navigating your own career and household budget, the core mechanics of survival remain the same.
Oh, absolutely. The principles scale to any level of decision making.
Think about the tragedy of the executive deaths we discussed earlier. That is a grim but vital reminder to build system redundancy in your own life and work. Don't architect a system where you are the single point of failure, carrying the entire operational load yourself.
Right. You need a backup plan.
Yeah. And think about the founder's dilemma regarding inflexibility. Are you remaining open to new, contradictory evidence? Or are you stubbornly driving a project toward a slow, agonizing crash because you just refuse to admit you aren't smart enough to do it alone?
It's a tough question to ask yourself.
It is. And finally, understand the hidden cost of illiquidity. Having paper wealth or a great title means nothing if you can't pay the daily toll that time extracts.
And, you know, if you are navigating this ecosystem and want to test your assumptions, the author actually provides a really cool venue for it.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Fred Cohen hosts a free monthly advisory call. It's this open space where you can pitch your company's situation and learn from the operational friction others are experiencing.
Yeah, those calls are usually at 0900 Pacific time on the first and third Thursday of most months. It's a rare chance to step out of the isolation of building a company and actually look at a map with fellow travelers.
That's enough.
Because as the text perfectly summarizes, the journey is never what you see on the cover of a business magazine. The final warning in the notes is incredibly vivid. It literally states, "The road to exit is rough, long, and dusty. Prepare your gas mask for the stink along the way."
I love that quote. Forget the confetti. Bring your gas mask.
Seriously.
It brings us right back to the contrast between the mythology of the launch party and the grueling reality of the desert. And it leaves you with a really critical question to ponder on your own.
Yeah. We've established that the vast majority of startups crash either fast or agonizingly slow. We know the rare successes lock up your capital in an illiquid vault for a decade while demanding millions in outside liquid wealth just to survive the weight against inflation.
Right, which raises the ultimate question. Is early stage angel investing actually a rational financial strategy? Or is it fundamentally an incredibly expensive psychological thrill ride disguised as economics?
That is the question. Are you investing in a business model, or are you just buying a very stressful decade-long ticket to a roller coaster that might end up stranded in the desert?
It's a lot to think about.
It sure is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the glossy narratives, and we'll see you next time.